a free relationship. I don't necessarily mean a captive one, but a, you know, with free ranging or orangutans, you don't have to penetrate through their species. You can relate to them, and they relate to you as one individual to another. So I'll give you an example. I remember once I was in a zoo, and I was allowed to go into the back area, and there was a gorilla male silverback in a cage, and there was an orangutan adult male in another cage. I mean, they knew I worked with orangutan, and they knew if an orangutan bit my finger, that it would be my fault, not theirs, right? Anyway, so I'm feeding the adult male orangutan raisins, right? And I'm putting my fingers right into his mouth, his open mouth. You know, my fingers are in his mouth, maybe up to the second knuckle, you know, half the fingers in there. And I'm thinking, I don't even know this orangutan. Like, why am I doing this? But doesn't matter. You know, he's taking the raisins. And I noticed that the silverback gorilla was watching very intently. So I thought, well, maybe he wants raisins. I think he did. So I walked over there, and I kind of, you know, raising my hand, kind of motioned that I was going to give him a raisin. And he just went berserk. I mean, he was, you know, going from one end of his cage to another. He was banging the, you know, the bars of his cage so much that I thought he was going to pull them out of their sockets. I mean, he had to show me that he was a gorilla and that I was just too presumptuous just to come up to him and hand him a raisin. You know, so we had to go, we had to work through his gorillaness. But, I mean, the orangutan didn't bother. Like, you know, here was somebody giving him raisins, and, you know, why should he demonstrate that he's an orangutan and I'm a human? You know, it was a total different kind of sensibility. And I think it's because orangutans, even though obviously they're orangutans, but first they're individuals. And so that makes it possible to have relations with them that tend to be more like human relations, I think. I mean, they kind of open themselves up to you.
And that's not the only thing we have in common.
And let me tell you, nothing does it for an orangutan as much as good food. Well, because their whole lives are about food, and that's why they're solitary. So the orangutans are ripe fruit eaters, and they eat the succulent, sweet flesh of fruits. And that's why fruits are brightly colored and sweet, you know, so seed dispersers will eat them. And you can enter a fruit tree, and if it's full of ripe fruit, you can eat all the fruit. But if there's two orangutans, then you only get half the tree. If there's three, you only get a third of the tree. So over the countless generations, orangutans have gotten bigger. They're the largest arboreal animal. And they go into a tree, and I have seen them sit for 8 hours in a tree, eating all the ripe fruit, while their sister, sibling, you know, is half a kilometer away, a kilometer away, in her own tree. And also this goes to mating. So an orangutan female has a tree, she's sitting in a tree, and an adult male comes up, shows up. And he's two or three times as big as she is, because he has to fight other males to get access to females. Now, I mentioned that orangutans only give birth once every 8 years. So that means they come into receptivity, or proceptivity, like they want to mate, only during a very short period, every 8 years. So if you're an adult male, you're only going to mate. You're only going to have that window, that very narrow window. So he shows up. He's 300 pounds. She's 90 pounds. She's sitting in a tree. And what does she think? She thinks, go away. Don't eat my food. Don't eat my fruit. And so when she's receptive and wants to mate, then she's willing to tolerate him. And so they'll travel together for several days, mate. Of course, the male tends to initiate the mating if it's an adult female. But then, maybe on the fourth or fifth morning, the male wakes up in his nest. He usually makes his nest close to where the female has made her nest. And he looks around, and she's gone. Where is she? You know, he looks here, looks there. He long calls, you know, long calls, so to announce his presence. You know, he's calling her. She's nowhere to be seen because she left in the middle of the night. She left early morning before he woke up because she does not know that mating's over. She's satisfied. She's done. She doesn't want to share her fruit with him. And it's very interesting because sometimes when the males and the female consort, the male tends not to eat so much. He spends more time just sitting there watching her. It's almost like he's fascinated by her. He can't get enough of her. Yeah. She's food for his body, kind of, food for his thought. But I think he is watching her. Maybe because he's fascinated, but maybe he doesn't want her to escape. Because, you know, she might make a run for it. It's all about food. You know, it's interesting, you watch orangutans, and they're so different from humans. They're such extraordinary animals, and they're, you know, very gentle, meditative, serene most of the time. And they live in a different world. And unfortunately, that world is dissolving. It's coming to an end for them. And this is what keeps me in the field. I mean, that's the reason. I don't want them to go extinct as populations in the wild.
However, in early 1971, Dr. Galdikas's work didn't just involve researching orangutans.
Actually, the first month that I got there, we started rescuing captive orangutans, wild-boar captive orangutans, from a life as a pet or in captivity. And we started, you know, raising them, and then the rest of them were quite young. These were usually people's pets or intended to be people's pets. And so we started rescuing wild-born ex-captive orangutans, and we have now released close to 1,000 back, well, maybe not 1,000, 600 or 700 in the 50 years that I've been there, almost 50 years back to the wild. And most of them have prospered. But now the problem is there's not enough forest to release them. We can't find, we have almost 300 wild-born ex-captive orangutans in our facilities. We have 14 release stations where we release them. But now it's like there's no more forest because the forests outside the national park are being annihilated. Millions of hectares of tropical rainforest have been cut down in Southeast Asia and are beginning to be cut down in Africa and in South America, Central America, for palm oil. And of course, you know, part of the effect of all those forests being cut down and burned is all the carbon dioxide that gets emitted into the world's atmosphere, which of course contributes to global warming.
In fact, 174 tons of CO2 are released every year into the atmosphere for every hectare of tropical rainforest destroyed in Indonesia and Malaysia.
Palm oil is a real problem. It's basically an African weed. That's where it came from. And when I say it's a weed, archaeologists in our department here at SIPU who work with African agriculture say that you can't really tell when it became domesticated, because it kind of followed the villages around. Villages, that village was established, and there was palm oil that grew up around it. And that's because palm oil is a very hardy plant, and this has made it the most widely used vegetable oil on the planet. It's cheap to grow. As I said, it's a weed. You get enough All it needs is sunlight and enough water and some fertility in the soil. Now, if there's palm oil from sustainable sources, that would be wonderful. But the problem is, they often say, oh, this is sustainable palm oil. And I think, what do they mean? They cut down a forest, burned a forest, killed all the orangutans inadvertently or advertently, and they say it's sustainable. Sustainable for what? Well, sustainable for the palm oil. You know, so there is sustainable palm oil, but it's found in little-known places like small landholders in Ecuador, where small landholders have converted, just changed their crops. You know, those fields have been utilized by the Incas and the previous people for hundreds of years, if not thousands. And so these Andean farmers, whatever, have changed to palm oil because palm oil is so lucrative. Okay, that's sustainable. Because if those forests were cut 1,000 years ago, what are you going to do? But if those forests were cut 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I think that's a different story. And if the orangutans were extirpated 20, 30 years ago, that's not sustainable. So I try not to eat palm oil as much as I can. The problem is, you know, it's the great pretender. So when you see vegetable oil on a package, it almost invariably means palm oil, because those people who produce canola oil or, you know, sunflower oil or olive oil are very proud of those oils, because those are expensive oils. You know, they're not cheap. They're rare, relatively rare. Avocado oil, you know, lots of oils.
Yeah, I've always wondered that, too. Like, why is it not labeled, right, on the package? Like, it's, you just say vegetable oil or, like, hydrogenated oil, but it's like you always know, like, yeah, it comes from palm oil, right?
Yeah.
Inevitably, in the end, right? It's just...
It's cheap.
There's got to be some kind of pressure from the consumers, right? That we got to say, like, label this, right? Tell us, you know, inform us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you eat clean, which is avoid processed food, then you don't have to use palm oil. I mean, some of the things I really tried to do is cut down on the processed food. And I remember when I consciously made an effort to avoid palm oil, which occurred a few years ago, I lost 5 pounds in 2 weeks. Like, I mean, that told me something. Palm oil isn't particularly healthy for you either.
Yes.
If you've had a heart attack.
There's been links to, like, cardiovascular diseases.
Well, if you've had a heart attack, they tell you not to to use it. And, of course, as humans fragment their forests and diminish their forests, they're changing. They're under stress. And of course, humans kill them, and, you know, there's conflict over fruit trees, even. Because orangutans, if they have nothing to eat in the forest, they'll, the forest is gone, they'll come into people's, you know, orchards and gardens and eat their fruit. And of course, people get upset. They depend on what they grow, you know. That's where their food comes from. So they tend to be intolerant of animals eating their food crops. They will kill orangutans. They will kill other animals that come and raid their rice fields. So the future is not the best for any of the great apes, including orangutans.
Can you, can hear me? Can you speak on what extinction of orangutans look like if we're continuing to head in the direction that we're heading?
You mean the extinction?
Yeah. Like, what does that look like?
What does that look like, yeah, in terms of, like, you know, yeah, as we progress forward? Right.
Well, it's very interesting that you asked that question, because I think it's like the title of that movie, Eyes Wide Shut. But it actually appears right in front of us, and we don't see it. Most of the time, we don't see it. So most of the extinctions that have happened have not actually been documented very well. So they tend to happen out of sight and even out of mind, because it's not spectacular. You know, an animal dies in the bush. Arcus is covered by leaves. You don't even know that that's the last one of his subspecies or her species to die. So what extinction looks like, it's not like a blaring neon sign. It's not like that. It happens right in front of you without you actually seeing it. So how do I view orangutan extinction? Well, in the mountains of central Borneo, which are still relatively inaccessible, there's no roads up there, there would probably be lone, nomadic old males wandering the forests, never meeting anybody, long calling. Probably wondering why nobody is calling back. So that's what's going to happen. You're going to end up with a few males in the middle of Borneo calling, wondering why they have this domain all to themselves now. And they'll die. It'll be a him. The females will be gone because the females are not nomadic. The females tend to stay put in their relatively large home ranges. Males tend to be nomadic, so they wander. And the wild pigs will come and eat them, which they do. That's what happens to carcasses on the forest floor. I mean, it happens because animals don't advertise.
But there are solutions, as Dr. Galdikas tells us about the role of ecotourism.
So one of the things that we did very early on is we tried to build up tourism. Well, you know, the problem is if you're in an area where there's one plane a week, and that plane, if it doesn't come this week, you have to wait another week. And if there's no infrastructure, there's no hotels, if there's nothing, it's very hard to build up tourism. But as the area became developed, I mean, I would go out. I used to give a lot of lectures, more than I do now. And I would say, you know, if you really want to help the orangutans, come to Borneo. Come and visit. You know, make it clear to the local people and to the government, local, provincial, national, that you care about tropical rainforests, you care about orangutans. And actually, I gave a talk at the American Natural History Museum in New York, and I remember it was 1987, I think, that I gave a talk there, and one man heard me talk, and he came in 87, and then he started coming regularly in the 1990s. And he came for about 30 years, almost every year, every second year. And he died at 95. And the last time that he was there, he was 93. You know, so people like that, there was a lot of people who came, they liked it, they'd come back, they'd, you know, let their friends in North America or Europe know, mainly North America. And the tourism gradually built up. There was a hotel that built a resort-like lodge on the boundary of the national park, and they started advertising. And now, in 1971 and 1972, we had zero visitors, zero, aside from Indonesians. And then in 1973, we had two visitors, or one visitor. In 1974, we maybe had two. And now, we have 18,000 a year. So it began in the 21st century, and it's making a difference because there are at least several hundred local men and women, actually a few women as well, who are now making their livings from being guides. And of course, what this has done, and also boats, there are at least 50 klotoks, which are like African queens. You remember the movie, African Queen? Those kinds of boats with inboard motors, kind of. There's at least 50, 60 boats on the river now. And the people have cooks, you know, and they have the captains and the captain's assistant. So several people make their livelihoods off those boats. Of course, the boat owner might not even be on the boat. So thousands of people are making their living from the orangutans and from the forest. And what that has done is that it has built a constituency for orangutan conservation and forest conservation. Unfortunately, it hasn't yet spread to all orangutans. It's concentrated on the orangutans in the national park where the guides normally take the tourists.
I really wanted to ask where was it? Yes, okay. Can you share, I should speak a little bit closer. What message or advice do you have for our generation to be good stewards of the planet?
Well, I'd say the first thing is become a vegan. You know, the consequences of raising, you know, all that flesh and meat to eat is tremendous.
A lot of energy. Hmm? A lot of energy goes into that. Wasted energy.
I'm sorry?
Wasted energy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've done all kinds of studies. Even eating chickens. I gave up eating chickens a while ago, you know, because the amount of forest that is destroyed for cattle ranching in places like the Amazon is tremendous, and like you said, it's wasteful. The second thing is try not to consume palm oil. I mean, if there's one thing that people can do that makes an immediate difference for orangutans is avoid palm oil. You know, when I think about unsustainable palm oil, I mean, it's like eating or drinking orangutan blood or given blood. I mean, that's how severe it is. I'm waiting for the day when they will actually have sustainable palm oil. I think the third thing is to live a life that's as clean and as noble as possible. I think that ultimately will help orangutans and gibbons and many of the wildlife that is going extinct in certainly locally in Southeast Asia. Yeah, so I think those three things. But the first is try to eat as little meat as possible. And I heard a wonderful talk by actually an actor, female actor, Alicia Silverstone, and she said about vegetarianism and veganism. She said, you know, just don't give up. Just keep on trying. You're not going to be perfect, but make the effort, because it's going to make a difference ultimately. You know, I think that's one of the best trends among young people nowadays. In the United States, I think about 20% of high schoolers now are either vegetarian, vegan, or leaning in that direction. And that's going to have an impact on what happens to this planet. I think also people choosing not to have too many children. Mm-hmm. I think if you have 8 or 9 children nowadays, it's being irresponsible towards the Earth. Mm-hmm. So the Earth can't support more. Yeah. And if you've seen those Bornean jungles disappear under the onslaught of people, mm-hmm. wonderful people, smiling people, gracious people, you know, which are the Indonesians, you know, probably the most wonderful people on the planet, if you took kind of, you know, measures of smiling ratios and things like that. Very gracious people, very hospitable. But yet, you know, they swarm in and destroy the forest. When you go into pristine places, you often destroy them. So sometimes it's good to go to places, you know, which are already developed. So, you know, I sometimes go to places, and even in British Columbia, I won't go on the tour, I won't do anything like that, but I'll just go to the souvenir shop. I know my job as a tourist. And I'll buy souvenirs. And then I'll give them away as gifts. I mean, I know what my job is. My job is to help the local economy wherever it is.
Right.
Yeah, it's not to destroy the wilderness. We need to think very carefully about what we want to do as human beings and how we want to interact with nature. So We need to respect nature to the point where we sometimes sacrifice our own satisfaction. People can help.
Yes.
That's the message.
Yes.
There's a number of things that people can do.
Right.
And sometimes they don't seem direct, but they are. Eat less meat for other things. Let that chicken live.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, great.
I mean, and I could talk forever. My lectures are 3 hours.
Right, right.
And then I would very much appreciate if somebody would walk me.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
I can. I don't have my compass. And I'm known for getting lost without my compass.
Right. Okay.
And this is
now
all
we can
because,
walk you back.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Oh, this construction, you know, it's...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're just...
You can learn more and support orangutan conservation at orangutan.org.
And you can follow Dr. Galdikas on Twitter at Dr. Birute.
We would like to thank our instructors for supporting our project.
CGSF for providing us the space.
And of course, Dr. Galdikas for taking time out of her busy schedule to speak with us.
Thanks for listening.
That's a wrap.
And created with CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
Really? Really, Nick?
I get my brain so small. I gotta...
Do you want me to... Is that better? Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thanks to the science communication class for putting that together and sharing a little bit about the life and legacy of Birute Galdikas. I'm Jesse. This has been Speak Up. Up next is Democracy Now! I will see you next week.
Is Bird Note. Loons are built for life in the water. They're streamlined and dense to pursue fish deep below the surface. Loons' legs are placed far back on their bodies, almost like propellers, a unique advantage for life on the lake. But those legs don't work well on land. That's why, if you see a loon on terra firma, something has probably gone wrong. During migration, loons sometimes mistake wet pavement for the reflective surface of deep water and try to land there. And once they've touched the ground, they're stuck. Loons can't walk more than a short distance, and they're so heavy that they need at least 100 feet of water to launch into the air. If you see a stranded loon on a road or parking lot, calling a wildlife rehabilitator can help start the process of returning that bird to safety and back on their migratory journey. Early spring is a good time to keep an eye out for them when loons are on the move and the weather is wet. By looking out for migrating loons, people can help ensure these submarine-like birds reach their northern breeding grounds safely. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Support for Bird Note is provided by Sarah Murner and Craig McKibben from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Volunteering at CGSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.